Purpose is a life without joy. World-weary, perpetually exhausted, he takes no pleasure in reflecting that he has been training Jedi Knights for 800 years. Apparently none of that has given any cause for celebration. He shows no inclination for song or delight in any form. His spirit of renunciation, "You must unlearn what you have learned," implies a rejection of emotion and comes close to the sort of Buddhist injunction, "Give, sympathize, control," familiar to modern readers of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, or in its more recent and popular Zen manifestations. Such an implicitly dualistic attitude has closer affinities with the legacy of the Puritan suspicion of life embodied in flesh, a view filtered through to the modern world via American transcendentalism, than it shares with the sense of a unity of mind and body, as well as the unity of being, as it does in Aristotle, or in the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. Aristotle takes a holistic approach in conceiving of the relation of body and soul, or mind. In his philosophy, matter and form are indivisible, except for purposes of analysis. Unlike Plato, he doesn't depreciate matter or flesh, or denigrate it as a source of trouble or pain. Instead, Aristotle argues that matter joined with form actualizes being, and being is good. Aristotle would have no trouble answering the question posed by an agonized Hamlet, to be or not to be. Without matter, form cannot be individualized. That is, there can be no individual beings without it, while matter without form doesn't even exist. The same split between mind and matter in Lucas's film is a familiar feature in much of the thinking about science going at least as far back as Francis Bacon, 1521 to 1626. Science and technology, in this post-Renaissance view, emphasize discovery as a source of power over nature, rather than as a discovery of truths about nature and man's relation to the rest of the universe. Seeking power over nature easily becomes a kind of combat, with man pitting himself against the material universe. Yoda's teaching Luke to levitate a rock while standing on one hand demonstrates more than training and concentration. Perhaps it even shows the same will to overcome matter and gravity that appears in the modern impulse to balance massive skyscrapers on slender fingers of steel and concrete. More importantly, it's in keeping with the spirit of nature as an obstacle to be overcome that the robots exhibit mind, overcoming the limitations of flesh, and the comic rebuilding of C-3PO after having been blown apart by an enemy shot only dramatizes the implied insignificance of the relation of body to mind. In the same scene where C-3PO is reconstructed, the body becomes a series of interchangeable parts. Even as C-3PO comically scolds Chewbacca for getting its head on backwards, the robot evokes pity, as if it were a human patient in an operating room. Clearly lacking real flesh and life, lacking even that artificial life of a Frankenstein monster patched together from the flesh of unwitting donors, the robot has assumed a completely human role. Its dialogue with human characters and their paternalistic feelings toward the incessantly gabbing machine conspire to evoke smiles at one moment, pity and fear at the next, and so confuse the human and the technological. Having taken on the capacity for human interaction, R2-D2 and C-3PO operate like minds severed from organic bodies and installed in machines. As fleshly sense disappears, body is reduced to the status of an automobile, albeit one capable of absorbing and processing data, whose parts are as interchangeable and as valuable as the springs on a car. Aristotle's inseparability of body and mind disappears. Watching C-3PO's parts being tinkered with carries the conviction that body no longer has any integral relation to thought, any more than a car can be said to participate in the experience its driver is having. Thus, separating mind and body and rejecting the latter as insignificant to humans and irrelevant to thought blurs a proper distinction between humanity and technology, and so advances the theme of humanizing technology, giving it plausibility it wouldn't otherwise have. Similarly, humanizing technological puppets makes it easier to think of human beings as something like robots with interchangeable parts. The Empire Strikes Back develops this theme to such an extent that in the closing moments, when Luke's bionic hand replaces the real one he has lost in battle, the new appendage appears not only to be identical with and equal to the original, but even preferable to the flesh and blood hand. This bionic hand, so the film suggests, can be replaced by any number of similar devices. Luke's expression of admiration as he flexes his new technological fingers marks a triumph over nature. In contrast, Aristotle lavishes several pages of his Parts of Animals to the wonders of natural human hands. He emphasizes elsewhere that just as a stick in the hand cannot be the source of movement, neither does a hand move itself. Instead, its movement has its source and coordination in the soul. In The Empire Strikes Back, flesh does not really matter, and the expression of revulsion toward the stink of real flesh actually assists in encouraging a preference for an odorless, mechanical substance. Nature does everything for the sake of something, says Aristotle, for whom nature is the norm. In The Empire Strikes Back, that attitude is reversed. Technology exists not only as a subject, technology becomes the norm. While body parts can be replaced, that isn't true of the person. For Aristotle, and indeed for an entire tradition in Western philosophy that includes Cicero, Thomas Aquinas, and their modern counterparts, such as Etienne Gilson, Peter Gesch, and Henry Veitch, each person is unique. The primary feature of the person is so obvious that a description of a person might well overlook it. A person is unique and thus irreplaceable. The basis for the individual self is in what Aristotle calls primary substance. Each person is thus like a fingerprint, unique to that individual in a world in which all individuals share in having fingerprints. However, many parts are interchangeable. Persons, as persons, are never interchangeable. Human beings share in common nature. They continue to beget and replace other human beings, all having in common their humanity, as well as physical features like arms and legs. Yet while limbs can be lost and artificially replaced, the uniqueness of the person remains. Rejecting technology as a substitute for human norms and rejecting the converse, that humans are the equivalent of machines or computers, doesn't entail a rejection of the value of technology. The Empire Strikes Back attacks the distinctiveness of human beings by encouraging a view of humans in which the inseparability of mind and body no longer exists. Technology is proffered, instead is having the potential for becoming human. Where popular culture has given us a tin woodsman who longed for a human heart, technology has now given us a tin heart as a substitute, thus fulfilling that dream in reverse. To regard technology as a contribution to human life is one thing. To think of technology as the means of raising the status of human nature is to repeat the mistake of Jonathan Swift's Lemuel Gulliver, who returns from his last voyage having discovered a society of beings that look like horses, but display a rational understanding that far surpasses anything that Gulliver has experienced in human company, and develops a loathing for the human species. Totally misanthropic, he rejects his wife and children and chooses the company of horses in the barn. A preference for the products of technology must surely have the same result, an actual demeaning of the truly human, and a consequent rejection of the company of people in exchange for the barn and the company of horses, or mechanical dogs. The capacity for reasoning and feeling, for choosing and valuing, is distinctly human, insofar as it blinds us to this human distinctiveness. Humanizing technology ultimately results in dehumanization. Chapter 16. A Certain Point of View. Lying Jedi, Honest Sith, and the Viewers Who Love Them. Shanti Fader. Not long after our second, or was it third, viewing of Attack of the Clones, my boyfriend and I became involved in one of our not uncommon debates about Lucas's galaxy in general, and the Jedi in particular. As we argued the finer points of Jedi philosophy and mindset, he commented, "Isn't it interesting how the Jedi lie so much more than the Sith, and yet they're supposed to be the good guys?" Jedi enthusiast that I am, I automatically leaped to their defense, only to be stopped by the realization that he was right. The Jedi do an awful lot of lying and shading of the truth for a religious order that's supposed to be on the side of virtue. Obi-Wan Kenobi lies to Luke about his father. Yoda misleads Luke when he arrives on Dagobah. And Mace Windu covers up the fact that the Jedi are losing their powers. By contrast, the Sith do a surprising amount of truth-telling for villains. Count Dooku tells a captive Obi-Wan flat out that the Senate has been infiltrated by a Sith. Senator Palpatine, a.k.a. the Sith Master Darth Sidious, worms his way into power without speaking a single literal untruth. And of course, in one of the most famous moments in Lucas's entire epic, Darth Vader tells Luke the devastating truth that Obi-Wan has withheld. The more I thought about it, the more it baffled me. Honesty is generally seen as a virtue, except when someone asks you, "Does this make me look fat?" and lying as a terrible, hurtful vice. Why, then, would Lucas have his Jedi lie and his Sith tell the truth? As far back as Plato and Socrates, 5th and 4th centuries BC, philosophers have been wrestling with the puzzle of truth and falsehood in the process of coming up with a varied and fascinating array of ideas. I certainly don't pretend to have the answer to what truth really is, but in this chapter, I'll explore several possibilities raised by philosophers and reflected in Lucas's intriguing paradox. Just the facts. The search for truth is as old as the first human being who wondered about the meaning of existence, and as modern as the movies playing in today's multiplex. One of the primary purposes of mythology and religion is to seek the truth about our purpose in this life. What is truth? Pontius Pilate famously asked Jesus, and philosophy itself might be seen as an endless search for an answer to that question. But what exactly is truth? On the simplest and most literal level, truth is what corresponds to the facts. To be true, a statement has to correctly represent the way things really are. I can say, the ticket line for the Phantom Menace stretched all the way around the block. This statement is true if the ticket line did stretch all the way around the block, and false if I'm exaggerating due to my sore feet. George Lucas envisioned the Star Wars movies. Carrie Fisher played Princess Leia, and John Williams wrote the score. These are all facts, and therefore when I make these statements, what I say is true. But is truth really that simple? I believe there's far more to it. Factual truth is certainly necessary for a society to function. Merchants and craftspeople need to represent their products accurately if they want to keep their customers. No legal system can function without factual honesty. Witnesses in court swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and are punished if caught in a lie. On a more personal level, trust is one of the most important ingredients of relationships. But telling the truth isn't as easy as simply reporting facts. As anyone who's had to deal with an opinionated boss, an insecure friend, or nosy in-laws can confirm, people lie for many reasons. To make themselves look better, avoid blame for something they've done, protect a loved one who's fallen afoul of the law, or gain something they can't or won't try to get through honest means, among others. This is particularly true when a society's leaders fail their people or commit a wrongful act. Those holding power are usually unwilling to relinquish it and seldom hesitate to cover up their error. This drama manifests in Star Wars as the decline and fall of the Old Republic era Jedi Order. In Attack of the Clones, the Jedi have found themselves in a terribly awkward position. They're losing their connection to the Force. The Jedi are peacekeepers, an order of religious knights not unlike the Templars of European history, or the Round Table of Arthurian legend. And if it became known that their powers were fading, they would also lose the awe and respect previously accorded them. That the Jedi are indeed viewed this way is established by the Trade Federation officials' reaction to Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn in The Phantom Menace. In order to carry out their duties as the guardians of peace and justice, they feel they're forced, no pun intended, to break their own moral code. How long the Jedi would have been able to maintain the pretense is uncertain. The illusion of power seldom lasts very long with nothing to back it up. Later, we'll examine whether or not this deception is justified, but it's unquestionably a lie in the simplest and most straightforward sense. Then there are the Sith. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900, who was very interested in both truth and power, and enjoyed questioning traditional morality, could easily have had Palpatine in mind when he wrote, "The intellect unfolds its chief powers in simulation, for this is the means by which the weaker, less robust individuals preserve themselves. In man, this art of simulation reaches its peak. Here, deception, flattery, lying and cheating, talking behind the back, posing, living in borrowed splendor, being masked, the disguise of convention, acting a role before others than before oneself. In short, the constant fluttering around the single flame of vanity is so much the role and the law that almost nothing is more incomprehensible than how an honest and pure urge for truth could make its appearance among men. Here we begin to see that truth is not so simple. While Palpatine, for the most part, doesn't tell direct falsehoods, his words are always layered with hidden meanings, most of them for the benefit of the audience members who know exactly what he's really after. So much of what Palpatine says in episodes 1 and 2 seems directed at the audience rather than his fellow characters that I'm tempted to suspect that his Sith powers include the knowledge that he's fictional and the ability to read ahead in the script. The best example of this, interestingly, is his acceptance speech upon being granted emergency powers by the Senate in Attack of the Clones, the very speech that appears to be his most blatant lie. "I love democracy," Palpatine proclaims. Of course he loves it. Democracy is the tool that granted him a smooth and bloodless rise to absolute power. Just because he discards the tool when it's no longer necessary doesn't mean it didn't please him while he was using it. As for his pledge to lay his power down once the crisis was resolved, clearly Palpatine wasn't thinking of the same crisis as the rest of the Senate. As late as Return of the Jedi, Palpatine, now the Emperor, still sees threats to his power and to the Empire he rules. If he doesn't consider his crisis resolved, he's being true to the letter of his speech. And if the Senate heard something other than what Palpatine secretly believed, we in the audience know better. Like Obi-Wan, Palpatine lied only from a certain point of view. Judge me by my size, do you? One of the pleasures I took from my first viewing of The Phantom Menace was hearing scattered, horrified gasps from the audience when Queen Amidala first addresses that helpful, gray-haired man as Palpatine. The kindly senator is a facade designed to deflect suspicion away from himself, while he maneuvers everyone around him, including the Jedi, who really should have known better, into liking him, trusting him, and giving him exactly what he wants. Palpatine takes control of the Senate without personally spilling a single drop of blood, because he conceals the fact that he's really a ruthless, power-hungry, and vengeance-seeking Sith Master. The few times we see him as Darth Sidious, his face is hidden behind a heavy hood. Then there's Yoda. When we first meet him, neither Luke nor the audience has any idea that this comical, wizened little chatterbox could be the great Jedi Master whom Luke was sent to find. Yoda doesn't reveal his identity, but keeps up the game until Luke figures it out on his own. How is this any different from Palpatine's actions? The difference can be found not in what the two characters are doing, but in why, in the intention behind their actions, and of course, their ultimate consequences. The reasons behind a person's actions can be every bit as important as the actions themselves. And while many philosophers, such as Immanuel Kant, 1724-1804, would say that lying is never defensible, others, including utilitarians, believe that there are times when lies are harmless, or even beneficial. That is, when they would produce the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Nietzsche goes even further, dismissing conventional morality altogether, and declaring that truth is nothing but the specific set of lies accepted by a particular society. Turning briefly away from Palpatine and Yoda, we can now look at the Jedi Council's decision to conceal the waning of their powers and ask, what was their intention? They may have honestly thought that their lie served the greater good, letting them continue to act as peacekeepers and negotiators. Certainly, the galaxy becomes a harsher place once the Jedi are eradicated or forced into hiding. In the end, though, however altruistic their intentions might have been, the Jedi certainly appear to be lying to hold on to power. Palpatine's intentions have no such shades of gray about them. He wants to take over the Senate, overthrow the Jedi, and make himself the single supreme ruler of the entire galaxy. He wants power for its own sake and uses deception to gain it. Yoda, on the other hand, doesn't deceive Luke for power or personal gain, with the possible exception of Luke's flashlight, with which he stubbornly refuses to part. His motives are similar to those of the Tibetan Lama, Marpa the Translator, who misled and toyed with his would-be student, Mila Repa, for years, demanding near-impossible physical labor and repeatedly refusing to give him instruction or initiations, before finally relenting and taking on the incredibly patient youth. A more modern example would be the old karate master, Mr. Miyagi, from The Karate Kid, who commands his baffled student Daniel-san to perform endless chores before revealing that they were actually cleverly disguised lessons, with the side benefit of giving Mr. Miyagi a clean house and shiny cars. To understand Yoda, we need to realize that he, like Marpa and Mr. Miyagi, is playing the trickster. Tricksters are found in myth and story throughout the world. They're usually wise and powerful beneath a playful or even foolish exterior. Tricksters disguise themselves and play pranks in order to test people, disrupt their preconceptions, or jolt them into a new way of thinking. Yoda's behavior tested Luke, exposing the young man's faults, his impatience, impulsiveness, and incomplete understanding of the Force, faults which Luke would have tried to hide, consciously or not, if he'd known he was facing a Jedi Master. Yoda's primary lesson is that in order to use the Force, one must look beyond appearances. Palpatine embodies the negative side of this lesson, with his kindly face and hidden lust for power. Yoda, powerful and enlightened beyond what his wizened exterior would suggest, embodies the positive. Truth and the Marketplace. Truth, then, is less obvious than it initially seems. People aren't always what they appear, and words that sound honest can be colored by hidden meanings. But this hardly explains or solves the paradox of the lying Jedi and honest Sith, particularly not in the case of Obi-Wan Kenobi, whom we first meet as a wise desert hermit and mentor figure. Why would such a person lie to Luke? From one perspective, this is a terrible act, a betrayal of young Luke's trust, a way to manipulate him into joining the battle on the Jedi's team. When Obi-Wan's lie is exposed, Luke is shattered to the point of very nearly choosing death. But from another perspective, Obi-Wan wasn't trying to manipulate Luke, but to protect him.
"You can't handle the truth,"
Jack Nicholson shouts at the climax of A Few Good Men. Not all truths are pretty or easy to face. And just as some forms of entertainment are too intense for young children, some truths are simply too much to handle for people at an early stage in their emotional and intellectual development. The Greek philosopher Socrates, 470 to 399 BC, compares the seeking of truth to shopping in a marketplace. An inexperienced shopper, who can't tell good merchandise from bad, may find herself swindled into buying food that's spoiled, unwholesome, or even poisoned. Or like Luke's Uncle Owen, buying a droid with a bad motivator. Nietzsche makes the uncomfortable point that we only actually want truths that are pleasant or that help us, and we're quite tolerant of lies that do us no harm. The Luke that Obi-Wan meets on Tatooine is young and sheltered. He knows nothing more complex than his aunt and uncle's farm, and sees the Jedi as perfect, shining heroes out of legend, not real people with frailties and human weaknesses. Obi-Wan feels that Luke isn't ready for the ugly truth about his father. As Socrates would put it, he doesn't yet have the wisdom to keep that knowledge from poisoning him. Most likely, if Luke hadn't rushed off to face Vader half-trained, he would have eventually learned the complete story in a gentler way. But for the time being, Obi-Wan offers the young Jedi a version of the truth that he could handle. Unexpected this is, and unfortunate. If Obi-Wan uses a lie to protect, the Sith use truth as a weapon. Vader tells Luke the truth about his parentage at the worst possible time, and in a way that inflicts as much pain as humanly possible. Truth without compassion is brutality. In Attack of the Clones, Yoda's renegade apprentice, Count Dooku, picks a similarly bad situation in which to tell young Obi-Wan that a Sith has infiltrated the Senate. Dooku even echoes Vader's dialogue as he invites the Jedi to join him, knowing that he'll either be believed and gain an ally, or disbelieved, in which case telling the truth actually covers it up. Neither Vader nor Dooku is telling the truth because he wants to increase anyone's knowledge or understanding, or lead them toward a more authentic life. Instead, they both use truth in an attempt to break a Jedi's faith in something they know and trust. In Obi-Wan's case, the Senate. And in Luke's case, Obi-Wan himself. And in doing so, make them question their loyalty. This, of course, works better in the case of the vulnerable, half-trained Luke. Despite his initial words of disbelief, Obi-Wan passes Dooku's information on to the Jedi Council, where it's largely dismissed. But even Luke doesn't give in entirely. Though shattered in body and spirit, he lets himself drop into the abyss below Cloud City rather than join Vader. Later, Luke returns to Dagobah, where Vader's story is reluctantly confirmed first by a dying Yoda, then by the spirit of Obi-Wan, in a dialogue that raises the question, was Obi-Wan's lie really a lie at all? In a strictly literal sense, it is. Darth Vader can't have killed Luke's father if he is Luke's father. But as we've seen in this chapter, truth is seldom as simple as the literal facts make it seem. Obi-Wan says, Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view. This isn't necessarily the evasive self-justification it appears to be. It could certainly be argued, as Obi-Wan does, that the good man and Jedi who was Anakin Skywalker was destroyed when he chose the path of the Sith and became Darth Vader. Vader says as much when Luke calls him Anakin.
That name no longer has any meaning for me.
To which Luke responds, it is the name of your true self. You've only forgotten. Changing one's name is a near universal way to signal a new identity, dying in a metaphorical sense to one's old self and being reborn. There's no denying, however, that Obi-Wan didn't originally intend Luke to understand his words in this metaphysical sense, any more than Palpatine expected the Senate to see through the layers of meaning in his acceptance speech. That intention makes it a deception, even if truth was buried in his words. It also brings the virtuous Jedi Knight uncomfortably close to the wicked Sith Master, one of the shadings into gray of previously one-sided characters that helps make the Star Wars films so interesting. The question of whether or not Obi-Wan really lied is less important than why he said what he said, his intentions. A parallel can be found in the parable of the House on Fire, which the Buddha tells to his disciple Shariputra. A wealthy man's house catches on fire. His children are oblivious to the fire and the danger it poses. They ignore their father's warnings and continue to play with their toys as the house burns around them. The father finally tells his children he's got wonderful carts outside for them, carts driven by each of their favorite animals. Delighted, the children run outside. The promised carts are not there, but in their place are carriages that carry them safely away from the fire. Buddha then asks his disciple whether or not the father in the parable is guilty of falsehood. Shariputra says no. The elder is not guilty of falsehood, for he has only enabled his children to avoid the calamity of fire and has thereby saved their lives. If that elder had not given them even so much as a single small cart, he still would not have been speaking falsely. Why? Because the elder previously had this thought, I shall use expedience to lead my children out. So when deception is used to attain noble ends, to assist someone whose awareness and understanding are incomplete, it really isn't deception. This is surprising coming as it does from the Buddhist tradition in which one of the basic tenets is right speech, which includes honesty. Perhaps Shariputra overstates his case and the elder has indeed told a falsehood, but nevertheless is not guilty, as no one would argue that lying to save an oblivious child from death is wrong. Obi-Wan's intentions are very much the same as those of the elder in the parable. He sees Luke in danger of falling into a life in which his spiritual potential will be squandered or corrupted, or quite possibly even losing that life before it had really begun. He sees as well that Luke is blind to that danger, so he uses expedience to lead the young man toward a more authentic life. Plato touches on a similar idea when he relates the story of Socrates and the noble lie. Socrates is faced with the task of explaining to the people of his hypothetical republic why they've been divided into social classes of craftspeople, guardians, and leaders. To convince them, he invents a fantastic tale of their having been formed, educated, and nurtured within the earth, along with their weapons and tools, and that precious metals have been mixed into them. Metals that equip each man for one specific task in life. Socrates himself acknowledges that this is a falsehood and seems reluctant to have told it. Glaucon, it isn't for nothing that you were so shy about telling your falsehood. Socrates, apparently so. Nevertheless, he feels, as Obi-Wan did, that it was a lie necessary for the greater good of his students. If reality fell short of Obi-Wan's hopes, it's as much the fault of the impatient student as of the teacher's lie.
Trust your feelings.
Truth can also mean a spiritual understanding and awareness that's not provable by cold, hard facts. In Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Harrison Ford's Dr. Jones draws a sharp line between the two when he tells a class full of adoring students that archaeology is the search for facts, not truth. He then directs any students who are after truth to a philosophy class down the hall. Obi-Wan's certain point of view comment may sound like a bald-faced attempt to cover his former lie. Luke certainly seems to think so. It is, however, an important reminder not to cling too blindly to a literal, mechanistic truth. According to Joseph Campbell, a mythologist who influenced Lucas, one of the central conflicts in Star Wars is that of man versus machine. The Empire, with its bland uniforms, faceless white-armored stormtroopers, a Sith Lord who's half-robot, and of course the technological terror of the Death Star, represents a loss of humanity, and with it, the ability to see truth from any perspective other than their own. A cold, mechanistic, power-driven perspective that sees no truth beyond bare facts. Machines can't see shades of meaning and are incapable of intuitive understanding. Everything is black or white, right or wrong. Furthermore, by refusing to acknowledge the viewpoints of anyone but themselves, the Empire renders outsiders less than human, mere things to be exploited and conquered. This is why the Sith are no better for their honesty. Not only is their version of truth a narrow, limited one, but they speak it only to serve their own purposes. Truth-telling for the Sith has nothing to do with increasing wisdom and understanding. It's just another tool to help them gain power or hurt their opponents. Ironically, in speaking more literal, factual truths, they lose the higher spirit of truth, that integrity that comes when honesty is practiced for the sake of illuminating the human soul. The Jedi try to hold this integrity. When they fail, valuing power above honor, they fall from grace and are nearly eradicated. Yoda tells Luke,
"A Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack."
And the same could be said about truth. Even if the intention toward a higher truth sometimes fails, as it did in the case of Obi-Wan and even more so in the Old Republic Jedi, it still serves a different and more noble end. Vader's truth brings Luke nothing but darkness. The same truth from Yoda and Obi-Wan brings understanding and compassion. Luke is finally the one who must sort out these layers of truth and deceit. In Return of the Jedi, he rejects both versions of who and what his father is and constructs his own truth, one that is at once stronger and more compassionate than either Vader's or Obi-Wan's truth. The symbol of the lightsaber helps illuminate this idea. Lightsabers are one of the most striking and memorable images to come out of the Star Wars films. Obi-Wan describes them as the weapon of a Jedi Knight, not as clumsy or as random as a blaster, and an elegant weapon for a more civilized age. They're futuristic, high-tech swords, and the sword has long been a symbol of truth, the weapon of knights and samurai, in many cases a physical manifestation of their honor. In the tarot, the suite of swords represents knowledge and the intellect, and the Ace of Swords in particular is often interpreted or even depicted outright as a blade of truth cutting through layers of deception and confusion. The Battle Hymn of the Republic speaks of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Like truth, a sword can be used for good or evil, to protect or harm. The only difference between a Jedi's lightsaber and that of a Sith is the blade color. In A New Hope, Luke is given his father's old blue-bladed lightsaber. He accepts it as willingly and unquestioningly as he accepts Obi-Wan's story. In The Empire Strikes Back, Vader slices off the hand holding that blade, an action as harsh and brutal as the truth he then speaks. Instead of joining Vader and constructing a new lightsaber under his instruction, Luke chooses to build one on his own, and presumably without instruction. Luke's choice of a green blade, representing life and growth, rather than a red blade, as the Sith all use, representing blood and death, is certainly not accidental. Later, Luke confronts the spirit of Obi-Wan, who finally tells him the full story behind Anakin Skywalker's fall and transformation. Interestingly, Luke's response, once past his initial bitterness, is to insist that there's still good left in Vader. Obi-Wan disagrees. He's more machine now than man, twisted and evil. But Luke is through with accepting the words of others, unquestioningly. Obi-Wan and Vader have given him only part of the story. The rest comes from his own intuition, the feelings that Jedi are told to trust above everything else. This is the truth of the heart, a truth beyond mechanistic facts or even shades of meaning, the final step in the path Luke chose when he turned off his targeting computer on the Death Star run. Luke seeks to build his own truth, trusting what he feels above what anyone else tells him. And as a symbol of this truth, he builds and wields his own lightsaber. For this reason, he alone is able to move beyond words, appearances, and the dizzying kaleidoscope of individual perspectives. He not only sees the spark of Anakin Skywalker flickering within the mechanical shell of Darth Vader, but redeems him and thereby helps bring down the Empire and the Sith against all expectations. In doing so, he redeems the fallen honor of the Old Republic Jedi and restores their truth to what it should have been. Philosophers in this galaxy have been debating the question of what truth is from a long time ago to this day. And if history is any indication, they aren't likely to agree on it anytime soon. But at least we finally have an answer to the question of the lying Jedi. They lie because truth isn't simple, and because they know that truth told without compassion can be brutal. Claiming that truth should always be told, regardless of other ethical considerations, is like claiming that there's nothing left of Darth Vader to be redeemed, true on only the most superficial level. Fans may not like to see their heroes as less than honorable, but the lesson of the lying Jedi is that truth depends on perspective, on intention, on intuitive understanding, and finally on a compassion that's willing to see the whole picture and not just a single point of view. Chapter 17. Religious Pragmatism Through the Eyes of Luke Skywalker. Joseph W. Long. In a memorable scene from A New Hope, a skeptical Han Solo tells the idealistic Luke Skywalker, "Kid, I've flown from one side of this galaxy to the other. I've seen a lot of strange stuff, but I've never seen anything to make me believe there's one all-powerful force controlling everything." Nevertheless, Luke becomes a hero because of his faith in his friends, his father, and most importantly, the Force, a mystical energy field in which he believes, but which he cannot empirically verify. The question of when to believe something and when not to believe is very important in the Star Wars galaxy, and in our own. In fact, this is one of the central questions in the crucial branch of philosophy known as epistemology, the study of the theory of knowledge. Epistemology is important to all of us because, clearly, some things should be believed and others not. It seems, for example, somehow right to believe in the existence of black holes and wrong to believe in the existence of unicorns. In this chapter, we'll explore the important matter of when to believe by first looking at the skeptical position of the 19th century philosopher William Clifford, and then putting this position to the test with the help of arguments from the famous pragmatist philosopher William James. A pragmatist is a person who is committed to a practical and human view of the world and of epistemology. Pragmatists, like James, argue that in addition to reasons that show the truth of what we believe, there are also practical reasons to believe in something. We'll call the former reasons truth-conductive, and the latter pragmatic. We'll see that William James's position, that a pragmatic faith belief can be a positive thing, indeed, our salvation, is exemplified well by Luke Skywalker. A lot of simple tricks and nonsense. In his 1874 article, The Ethics of Belief, William Clifford tells us that faith is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone. It's easy to see how one could maintain that faith or believing upon insufficient evidence is wrong in an epistemic sense, that it may not lead to knowing a truth. But Clifford believes it is also morally wrong. To explain why he thinks faith is immoral, Clifford tells us this story. A ship owner is about to send a ship full of immigrants to the new land. The ship owner is warned that the ship is old and weathered and not overly well built at the start, and may not make the long journey. Although he could have the ship inspected and repaired if necessary, the ship owner decides to trust in Providence. "It has made many voyages," he reasons. "Surely it will make this one also." Ultimately, the ship sinks, and the immigrants all perish. Now we can see why Clifford believes faith is morally wrong. It can lead to disastrous consequences. But what if the ship had made it to the new land successfully? "In that case, too," says Clifford, "the ship owner would be guilty, because he had no right to believe on such evidence as was before him." When Luke turns off the targeting computer of his X-Wing fighter and uses the Force to blow up the Death Star, he is guilty of the sin of faith. What makes holding a belief immoral is not simply a matter of whether that belief is true or false, or even whether it is fruitful or unfruitful, but rather of how it originated. The danger of faith is not only that we might have a false belief, or even that we should pass on a false belief to others, although this is bad enough. Still worse, if we should be in the habit of not seeking justification for our beliefs, we may become overly credulous and thus savage, like the barbarous sand people of Tatooine. Han Solo, at least the Han that we meet at the beginning of A New Hope, seems to be a skeptic like Clifford. Although he congratulates Luke on blowing up the Death Star, we can imagine how vexed he would have been if he were privy to Luke's unorthodox method. He believes the Force is nothing but a lot of simple tricks and nonsense, and no match for a good blaster at your side. We've all known people who adhere blindly to what they were taught as a child, never exposing themselves to experiences which might make them doubt. Clifford tells us that the life of such a person is one long sin against mankind, and I believe he has a good point. We'd hardly respect Luke if he had refused to enter the cave on Dagobah, where he faced his doubts and the knowledge of the dark side within himself. But does this mean that faith is always wrong?
"I find your lack of faith disturbing."
Of course, faith is not always advisable, and the Empire Strikes Back. Luke has unwarranted faith in his abilities as a Jedi, and foolishly leaves his training with Yoda to try to help his friends. The faith backfires and costs him dearly, as he loses his hand in an imprudent showdown with Darth Vader. But under certain conditions, William James argues that faith can not only be morally permissible, but even salvific, or hero-making. Luke Skywalker's actions ultimately help demonstrate this. James discusses the importance of hero-making faith in Ethical Importance of the Phenomenon of Effort. "The world thus finds in the heroic man its worthy match and mate, and the effort which he is able to put forth to hold himself erect and keep his heart unshaken is the direct measure of his worth and function in the game of human life. He can stand this universe. He can meet it and keep up his faith in it in presence of some of those same features which lay his weaker brethren low. He can still find a zest in it, not by ostrich-like forgetfulness, but by pure inward willingness to face it with these deterrent objects there. And hereby he makes himself one of the masters and lords of life. He must be counted with henceforth. He forms a part of human destiny. Neither in the theoretic nor in the practical sphere do we care for, or go for help to, those who have no head for risks or sense for living on the perilous edge. But just as our courage is so often a reflex of another's courage, so our faith is apt to be a faith in someone else's faith. We draw new life from the heroic example." What are these conditions that must obtain for faith to be morally acceptable? First, it is acceptable to have faith only when the choice is intellectually undecidable. If a little bit of thinking could decide the issue one way or the other, then we cannot simply choose to have faith. Also, the decision in question must constitute a genuine option. A genuine option is a choice which is living, forced, and momentous. A living option is one where there exist at least two real possibilities that may be chosen between. As a teen, Luke had few live career options. Perhaps he would be a moisture farmer like his Uncle Owen. Perhaps he could go off to the Imperial Academy next season after the harvest. But before meeting Obi-Wan Kenobi, being a Jedi Knight was not a real live possibility. It became a live possibility only after Obi-Wan told Luke about his father and after his aunt and uncle were killed by Imperial stormtroopers, Likewise, Han Solo's life choices are to be a mercenary or a smuggler, before his adventures with Luke and Leia. Only later could he realistically choose to be an officer of the Rebel Alliance. In addition to being live, a genuine option must be forced. A forced option is one where a decision must be made, or where choosing not to decide amounts to choosing one way or the other. Luke and Leia's decision to swing across the retracted bridge on the Death Star in A New Hope was a forced option. Choosing not to decide would be identical to choosing death, or at least surrender. Finally, a genuine option must be momentous. That is, it must be important and unique. Deciding to go to the grocery store to buy paper towels is not momentous. Nothing very important hinges upon the decision, and the decision could be made again at any time in the future. Obi-Wan's decision to respond to R2-D2's message from Princess Leia, however, is momentous. A great deal hangs upon it, and a decision must be made immediately, for as Leia pleads, "You are my only hope." Luke's decision to have faith in the Force seems to fit all of James's criteria. It seems clearly intellectually undecidable. How could Luke empirically test the power of the Force? One must believe in the Force in order to act through it. Thus, he could hardly have the scientific skepticism necessary to set up an appropriate experiment and still control the Force. His decision is living. Either believing or not believing is a real possibility. The choice is forced. If he chooses not to decide, then for all practical purposes, he has chosen against putting his faith in the Force. And finally, it's momentous. Trusting in the Force opens for Luke unique and important opportunities. So does this prove that Luke's faith in the Force is advantageous? Not yet, it seems. First, we must show that the advantage Luke could gain by believing a truth is greater than the disadvantage he could have by believing a falsehood.
"I don't believe it." "That is why you fail."
James and Clifford agree that believing truths and avoiding falsehoods are our first and great commandments as would-be knowers. But these are two different things. For instance, one could avoid error by believing nothing, but it seems clear there is value in believing some things, particularly true things. So which is more important, or does each have some worth? Clifford stresses the avoidance of error, but it seems to me that James is correct when he says that believing what's true is equally or even more important than weeding out false beliefs. Furthermore, some truths cannot be realized without faith. In The Empire Strikes Back, when even Han has become a bit of a believer, he intentionally flies the Millennium Falcon into an asteroid field to lose the Imperial TIE fighters chasing him. Han's belief in his ability as a pilot, despite great odds, 3,720-1 against by C-3PO's calculations, helps create the fact of his and his crew's survival. By choosing to believe in spite of a lack of justification, Han actually may help create a truth, the truth of his survival. And this hardly seems morally wrong. In some cases, it seems we can create truths through our beliefs. Take the often heard story of a man confronted by dangerous criminals in a dark alley. Instead of running from the criminals or fighting them, which would be futile, the man appeals to the good in the criminals, treats them as if they were loving people. And by treating the criminals as if they were loving, despite better evidence, the criminals are made loving. This is perhaps what happens when Luke confronts Darth Vader on the second Death Star at the end of Return of the Jedi. The Emperor, meanwhile, tells Luke that his faith in his friends is his weakness. But Luke's faith proves to be his saving grace. After Luke surrenders on Endor, he reminds his father there is still good in him, that he is still Anakin Skywalker. He does this with no justification, only faith. For Obi-Wan has told him Vader is lost. He's more machine now than man, twisted and evil. Eventually, Luke's faith saves him, as Vader kills the Emperor before the Emperor can destroy Luke. But Luke's faith is not only beneficial for himself, it also saves his father, for his faith turns Anakin back to the light side of the Force before he dies. It thus seems that there are certain circumstances under which it is not only morally acceptable to have faith, to believe without sufficient evidence, but it can also be salvific for oneself, and perhaps even for others. A New Hope. Faith is an important element of the Star Wars galaxy, but it is also important in our own. As a college teacher, I have learned the value of faith in the classroom. Before meeting a new class, I have no good evidence about whether my students will be good students or bad students. By good, I mean intellectually honest, critical truth seekers who are enthusiastic about philosophy. In fact, one could argue that I have inductive or circumstantial evidence that at least some of my students will not be good. After all, in the past, I always have had some students that lack enthusiasm or honesty, or are not committed to finding truth. Nevertheless, when I walk into a new class, I choose to believe that all my students are good students, and I treat them as such. Although I could be wrong, I believe that my decision to believe in the goodness of my students helps bring about the virtues of enthusiasm and honesty and commitment to truth in them. My reasons for believing in the goodness of my students is not truth conducive. That is, I don't hold this belief based on good evidence. Rather, as a pragmatist, I believe that there are practical reasons why one might be justified in believing something. For example, I believe in the goodness of my students because I think some good will come of it and no harm will be done. Yoda and Obi-Wan lack good evidence that Luke can become a Jedi and vanquish the Emperor and Vader. In fact, they have good reason to doubt Luke's success because of Anakin's failure. Like Anakin, Luke is
too old to begin the training,
lacks patience, and has
much anger in him.
Clifford would agree with Yoda's initial reluctance to train Luke. James, however, would recognize the potential for a great good that could come from doing so. And as we all know, James's pragmatic faith wins out in the end. A better example of pragmatic thinking from our own galaxy can be found in Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. In spite of a lack of truth-conducive evidence, and in opposition to the prevailing social conservatism, Reverend King chose to believe that his dream of whites and blacks standing hand in hand as equals could become a real possibility. Although the struggle is not yet complete, his dream seems to be coming true in 21st century America, and this could not have happened without his faith and the faith of others like him. Because of this faith, we are in a better world today. The example of Reverend King demonstrates how faith can allow us to find a good and a truth outside of ourselves and give us all a new hope. Masters of the Jedi Council. Hi there, I'm your narrator, Joseph Bevilacqua, and it's been a pleasure reading Star Wars and philosophy for you. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and my favorite character to read in the book was the Emperor, because I just love to
feel the hate flow through you.
Here's a little about the authors of each chapter. Gerald J. Abrams is Director of the Program in Health Administration and Policy and Assistant Professor of Business Ethics at Creighton University. He has published several essays on semiotics, ethics, and continental philosophy. It's true that he's getting older and his skin is getting greener, but when 900 years old you reach, look as good you will not. Robert Arp received a Ph.D. in philosophy from St. Louis University. He has published articles in philosophy of mind, ancient philosophy, modern philosophy, phenomenology, and philosophy of religion. He's calculated that his chances of successfully making any money doing philosophy are approximately 3,720 to 1 against. Judy Barad is a professor of philosophy at Indiana State University. She has published several books, including The Ethics of Star Trek, and is currently completing Michael Moore, The American Socrates. In addition to teaching courses in ancient and medieval philosophy, she teaches a course on philosophy in Star Trek. She uses both mind-melding and Jedi mind tricks to move back and forth between the Star Trek and Star Wars worlds. Christopher M. Brown is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the University of Tennessee at Martin. He has published in metaphysics and medieval philosophy and teaches courses in metaphysics, ethics, and the philosophy of religion, and the history of philosophy. Inspired by Obi-Wan Kenobi and fearing that Western civilization as we know it is soon coming to an end, he has found a safe place in Northwest Tennessee to hide out with his family until a new hope arises. Brian K. Cameron teaches philosophy and other Jedi mind tricks at St. Louis University. For a living, he bets on pod races, builds droids in his spare time, and engages in blind conformity. Elizabeth F. Cook is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Creighton University. She has published several articles in Applied Ethics and American Philosophy, particularly on Charles S. Peirce and Richard Rorty. She currently trains with the rebel forces to fight the evil empire, although she knows that if they strike her down, she will become more powerful than they can possibly imagine. Kevin S. Decker teaches philosophy at St. Louis University and Webster University. He writes on American philosophy, ethics, and social and political thought, and is active in progressive politics. These days, he's got a bad feeling about this. Richard Deese is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Rochester, with secondary appointments in neurology and medical humanities. He writes on political philosophy and has just published a book on the social and conceptual foundations of religious toleration, trust, and toleration. He also works in medical ethics and is particularly interested in technologies that enhance neurological functions. With his colleagues in neurology, he is currently looking into ways to increase midichlorian levels. Jerome Donnelly has taught at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and the University of Central Florida, Orlando, from which he recently retired. He has published criticism ranging from neoclassicism to popular culture, and maintains that many great works of literature and art have been popular, but that mere popularity isn't what makes works great. That includes Star Wars. Jason T. Eberle is assistant professor and co-director of the master's degree program in philosophy at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He has published in metaphysics, bioethics, and medieval philosophy. He was once involved in a duel at point-blank range, but foolishly waited until the other guy shot first. Thankfully, he missed. Shanti Fader received a BA in English from Mount Holyoke College in 1993. She is currently the associate editor of Parabola Magazine, a journal devoted to the study of myth and religious tradition, which has published a number of her essays, stories, and reviews. She can use her own hair to make the Princess Leia buns, and has won awards for her recreation of Padme's picnic dress. Richard Hanley is from Australia, where they make the good movies these days, and is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Delaware. He is the author of The Metaphysics of Star Trek, as well as articles on The Matrix, time travel, and more. Rumor has it he's a protocol droid. Jan Eric Jones is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Southern Virginia University. He has published on metaphysics and early modern philosophy, and has been known to subject innocent bystanders to hours of detailed discussions on why lightsabers are impossible. Light doesn't just stop 3 feet from its source. James Lawler teaches philosophy at SUNY Buffalo. He has written The Existentialist Marxism of Jean-Paul Sartre, and has a book on IQ theory that criticizes biological determinism, IQ, heritability, and racism. He has edited a book on the U.S. Constitution, The Dialectic of the U.S. Constitution, Selected Writings of Mitchell Franklin, and participated in a debate on socialism in Market Socialism, The Debate Among Socialists. His current book, Matter and Spirit, The Battle of Metaphysics and Early Modern Philosophy Before Kant, will be published by University of Rochester Press. Recognized at the age of 2 as being strong with the Force, Jim was nevertheless rejected for being too young. He never forgave the council and chose philosophy instead. This was no accident. Joseph W. Long holds a master's degree in philosophy from Colorado State University and is expecting a Ph.D. in philosophy from Purdue University in 2005. He has published articles on epistemology and critical race theory and currently makes his home in northwest Iowa, where it is only slightly colder than on Hoth. Walter Robinson, whose Buddhist name is Ritoku, which means gathering virtue, is a Zen monk and teaches East-West philosophy at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. The focus of his academic interest is Buddhist philosophical psychology, and his fantasy is to discourse with Yoda or Zen koans. William O. Stevens is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Chair of Classical and Near Eastern Studies at Creighton University. He has published on fate, love, ethics, and animals, the concept of the person, sportsmanship in the Cubs fan, and various topics in Stoicism. He can easily be mistaken for a Wookiee when he rouses in the morning. This is Joseph Bevilacqua for University Press Audiobooks. Thank you for listening. This audiobook, Star Wars and Philosophy, edited by Kevin S. Decker and Jason T. Eberle, is copyrighted in 2018 in the name of Redwood Audiobooks and is based on the book published by Open Court, copyrighted in 2005 in the name of Karis Publishing Company. To see the complete line of University Press audiobooks, please visit the website at www.universitypressaudiobooks.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.